Well, thanks for joining us today at GoldSeek.com Radio. Our featured guest, Louise Yamada. Honored to welcome today our featured guest, Louise Yamada, who makes her debut appearance on GoldSeek.com Radio. She formed the independent research company Louise Yamada Technical Research Advisors and is a well-known and widely respected market technician author who appears regularly as a commentator on CNBC. Good morning and welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio, Louise Yamada.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Well, we're glad to have you with us, and I wonder if we could begin the dialogue today with your technical view on the U.S. equities market. This week, the NASDAQ apparently topped that 5,000 benchmark, a number not seen since, I guess, the year 2000 dot-com bubble peak. Do you see signs of frothiness here, or could this be maybe the early stages of the next 20-year equities bonanza?
You mean for the NASDAQ itself? I think this time the NASDAQ has progressed quite nicely. All the way back to 2000, the NASDAQ really had an incredible collapse, came all the way back practically to 1,000 from 5,000, and then had a 13-year sideways consolidation. And the old saying is, the bigger the top, the bigger the drop, and the bigger the drop, the longer the need for repair. So when NASDAQ really broke out through 3,000 in 2012, we were suggesting that we had on our hands perhaps the beginning of a new bull market for the NASDAQ itself. And, of course, it's primarily made up of technology stocks. So as we approach 5,000 this time, there's been a little bit of a back off. But when price seems to move to these round numbers and historical levels, there's a psychology that takes time before you can get through, and I think you may get a little bit of hesitation going on over the next period of weeks, perhaps, before it can actually push through to a new high. But you don't have the outrageous valuations today that you had back in 2000. I mean, the stocks that are included now and are functioning as viable companies don't have 130 PEs. They have normal PEs, and some of them, like a Microsoft or an Intel today, are paying dividends. So it's perhaps a healthier situation.
I really like your comments regarding the way that the NASDAQ has progressed, this gradual progression. I'm sure you recall, I was there as well, 1999. It seemed like the market maybe doubled or even trebled in just a year or two. And we're not quite seeing that overenthusiasm just yet. But do you expect, though, that perhaps the speculation will come back into these markets?
I don't see it at the moment. I think that we have to recognize that a lot of the market that has progressed since 2009 has been because of the Federal Reserve has given so much liquidity. And the old saying, don't fight the Fed, as long as that liquidity is there, the markets have been able to rise. You're not getting much in the way of yield from, you know, Treasuries, so it's forcing people to go into something that could be considered a little bit more risky, and certainly is.
You mentioned liquidity, an important component of many of these rallies. Of course, maybe we don't have too much of a track record to go by. I mean, just the previous 1980s and 90s bull market, but it seemed to be an important factor. Listening to Dr. Yellen and many of the other folks, Fed officials and governors last week, there seems to be some inconsistency among the comments there. There's some doves and some hawks. Do you think that they will pull the trigger on higher rates, or has that really been discounted by the market so far?
Well, you could argue that it's already been discounted. Usually an initial interest rate rise doesn't rattle the markets that much. It's not till you get to the second, or even more importantly, the third, that the markets get rattled. But on the other hand, one economic comment that I've read, I mean, I'm a technician, but nevertheless, you see what's being written, is that this will be the first time, if they raise it, that it will happen so far or so many years into the economic recovery. But it's been a weak economic recovery. And, of course, one of the things that we actually wrote about in the mid-90s was looking for inflation in all the wrong places. We have a capital goods environment in this country that's a lot less than it used to be in the 70s when it was sort of rust belt in terms of machinery and that sort of thing. And now we're much more technologically oriented. And the technology itself, whether it's robots or making an office much more efficient, doesn't create the kind of inflation that occurred when you had something being produced and then it had that much inventory, and the more inventory there was, the less the price came down, or less inventory, the prices went up, that kind of inflationary pressure. Now the inflationary pressures, to my mind, are in consumer essentials like food and education and health care. And I'm not sure that that's being registered as a rise in inflation, but anybody who goes marketing knows perfectly well that there's inflation out there big time.
Very well said. And I think it's an interesting perspective you offer there with regard to the sea change that we've seen in our manufacturing sector, how technology and robotics have taken the forefront, and how that doesn't seem to lead to the excessive inventories. And plus, we have just-in-time processes today. Well, you know, in a recent commentary, you outlined the Dow-to-gold ratio. It's very interesting. A rising line tends to coincide with equities outperformance, and then when the trend is declining, gold tends to outperform. Now, since the 2011 commodities peak, equities have clearly enjoyed higher highs. And do you expect the trend with equities, you know, regularly making new highs relative to commodities and precious metals? Do you think that theme will persist here for some time?
I think it's just initiated a shift in favor of equities versus gold. And these are long shifts. The peaks in the ratio happened in 1929, 1968, 2000. I think that the decline that we've seen in gold over the past several years has certainly coincided with a continuation of the lift in equities, particularly the breakout in 2013 to a new all-time high in terms of the S&P and the Dow, suggests to us that gold is probably not finished with its bear market, doesn't necessarily have to go incredibly lower. But that any rallies that may occur in gold are going to be what we call contra-trend rallies, which are rallies in the opposite direction from the major trend, and they will probably coincide with any decline that we get as a contra-trend pullback in the equity market, which we still think is in a structural bull market, which initiated, you could say, 2009, but it was really not proven until we moved out to a new high in 2013. So yes, there will be interim moves, but I would suggest that gold probably will not go back to the 250 level where it was in 1999 or 2000, where it created its last basing. But it could settle somewhere around 1,100 or 1,000 or even 800 if it were to go there and start to stabilize at those levels. Maybe it'll stabilize at current levels. I'm a little skeptical. I think it might go lower. But if we get a correction in the equity market, you're bound to get a rally in gold, but it may not indicate that the bull market has reinitiated or is extending itself. It would just be a rally in an ongoing bear market from a technical perspective.
I share your sentiments here, and it's not easy for a lifelong gold bull to agree with it. But, you know, it's important that we accept the fact, the trend and the market dynamics. For many of our listeners with long-term perspectives, it could represent an excellent opportunity to increase their portfolio exposure to that wonderful insurance policy we call gold and silver. So I wanted to move on, though. You know, sometimes these established correlations that we find in the markets, they don't always hold. For instance, the U.S. dollar and gold tend to be negatively correlated. We've had this U.S. dollar rally, a stealth bull market, you might call it, in the last 9 months amid the sovereign debt issues in Europe and Greece and the Eurozone, capital fleeing that region in favor of our reserve currency. Do you expect the U.S. greenback to remain strong? And if so, what kind of impact could that have on the markets?
That's a very interesting question, which we've looked into. It's been a very impressive breakout. You've seen the price of the dollar exceed the 2009-2010 level, and now you've even seen it exceed the 2005 level. So you basically have almost a 10-year base. And here's the rest of the corollary that we talked about. Bigger the top, the bigger the drop. The bigger the base, the higher in space. And we have this 10-year base, as we had a 12-year base with the NASDAQ, and here in the dollar, I think the size of the base implies that it could go higher. We look back in history, and the last time that we had a very strong dollar corresponding to an equity bull market was from 1995 up to about 2002. So we could have a period of years ahead of us where the market continues to climb along with the dollar, and we'll have to evaluate, you know, what happens in between. If we're not correct, we'll pick it up somehow in the reversal in price. But there is that precedent, which was very interesting, and that was a period where technology was favored. And we are in another period where technology is favored. Technology and healthcare have really, until very recently, been the only things that have carried the market. So it has looked thin, which continues to suggest it may be due for some corrective trend once again. We've seen some of the consumer discretionary come to the fore, but it's been very selective. So that leaves us a little bit concerned about whether we're going to have another 5 or 6% pullback here. It's very difficult to pin the exact pullbacks, and with the Fed being comfortably easing all this time, everybody tends to buy the dips. We'll continue to evaluate it, and stock by stock is what's important. You watch your support levels, and if a stock breaks a support level or reverses the uptrend, you tend to take some off the table to protect your capital.
Keeping with the theme here that you've outlined, we have also seen the energy sector come under considerable pressure, and that's a big component of the S&P 500, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, and the interesting thing is that we track all of the sectors, and we track it with a relative performance to the S&P 500, because that's what the portfolio managers need. They need to outperform. We don't call up Mrs. Smith and say, I've got this great stock for you, it's going to underperform next year. And that's what we saw starting to come into the energy profile in late 2013 and early 2014. The relative strength for the energy versus the S&P was declining and broke a 6-year support. Well, obviously, from a technical perspective, the shorter a support break, the less important it is. But 6 years is very significant, which suggested to us that there was something out there that was not going to be favorable to the energy and energy stocks. And over time, of course, we were proven correct. And the important thing there is, by identifying that underperformance trend, it keeps people away from the stocks that are going to damage those stocks that they hold that are outperforming.
Here on the show, we always appreciate those that are technically minded, and because we want for investors to get their minds wrapped around the idea that we really can't outthink the market. There's a lot of sharp folks out there, and we're competing with millions of bright minds. Sometimes you just have to go with the flow and accept the trends and the technical breakdowns and breakouts. Do you have any comments? What's led you to embrace the technical side of the market as opposed to the fundamentals?
Well, because the principle of technical analysis is that it's a study of the supply and demand in the marketplace. An uptrend, for instance, is defined by higher highs, followed by higher lows, followed by higher highs. And the definition of a downtrend is lower lows, followed by lower highs. And the principle is that what you're seeing on a higher low is demand coming into place before price can break down to the low that it saw previously. Similarly, when a support is broken, the implication is that somebody out there smarter than you or I has perceived something about the company that is allowing them to take less, accept less, to get out of the stock. And that puts in place a first lower low, and then the rally is an opportunity to get out again, and then it'll go perhaps to a new low. those are some of the indicators that show that supply is coming into the marketplace or into an individual stock. And that's what we keep an eye on. I will say, just to ease the minds of listeners, is that it's becoming very difficult, even for professionals. I think Jack Bogle from Vanguard the other day said that 99% of what's going on in the equity market is trading, speculative trading, and only 1% is investment. So what we've been seeing, which has been frustrating to us as professionals, is that you get a stock that breaks out and then it turns right around and it breaks down, or vice versa. It'll break down and then it turns around and starts to go up again. And of course, if you've protected yourself and gotten out when it broke down, you can always get in again when it goes up. It's just that these moves have been happening so quickly that it's been very frustrating, even for the professionals.
As this very interesting discussion wraps up, would you please outline any other technical developments that your work and your colleagues have uncovered that maybe we haven't discussed today?
Covered pretty much everything. I think that currently there might be a little weakness here in the market, which we shared with clients as the month unfolded. But overall, until we start to see major topping formations the way we saw in 2000 and started getting people out before that decline, and the way we saw in 2007 when financials actually, interestingly, Chris, broke a six-year relative strength support. That was another major call that we had that got people out of financials before the incredible breakdown. Had no idea what was in the works or what was going on, but people were selling and the underperformance was in place. So we don't have any of those major tops yet in the markets themselves. It's a question of watching your individual stocks, and one by one, as they begin to deteriorate, you will have, you know, the eventual formation of a top in the market. We have had some concerns in the sense that we haven't seen as many new highs as this market continues to climb.
I wonder if you would please tell folks more about the services that you provide at Louise Yamada Technical Research Advisors and perhaps any contact information you'd like to make available.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well, we have a website. You can just Google my name, Louise Yamada. There's a little contact us button. We have an institutional report for money managers and mutual funds, and we have an individual report for individual investors and brokers or financial consultants, which is available on request, and we'll send a sample and details.
Very good. Well, Louise Yamada, we want to thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule. Please return soon.
Thank you very much, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.